Everybody, welcome to another edition of the ATL Alts Podcast. This is your host, Andre Sandate. I am excited to be here today recording with a friend and now a business partner, Robert Swarthout. Robert, welcome to the ATL Alts Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Robert, I alluded there in the opening that we started out, you know, as friends, and I started working with you as a consultant in your establishing Teton Crypto Capital, which we're going to hear more about here in a second. And then as things have evolved, last year I was able to join you as a partner in the firm. So excited to be introducing you to the ATL Alts community for the first time as a business partner, but also to hear, more importantly, an update on what's happening in crypto and digital assets. It's been a pretty wild year and a half since your first appearance on the show, to say the least.
Right. Yes. Yes. It's in some ways ho-hum for crypto, but wild for the rest of the markets, but even it's spicy in some sense for crypto. So yeah.
So we're going to dive into that. But, you know, what I would love is maybe for you, since we've had some time elapsed since that last show, when you came on and talked about setting up your firm and what you're doing at Teton Crypto Capital, maybe you could give a little bit about your background and tell the audience a little bit about the firm.
Yeah. So, you know, I come from a very traditional, non-traditional background when it comes to running a fund. I am a technologist, software developer, started and sold a few businesses and decided I wanted to do something different. And I turned a passion that was crypto investing for me personally into this fund so I could help others, initially just friends, and starting to expand it out. But it's been a fun journey. You know, I understand the technology piece and I'm learning more about it each day, but in some ways I'm playing catch up when it comes to understanding the mechanics of running a fund. At least initially, I think at this point it's pretty well rehearsed, what we do, say monthly or quarterly, but it's been a fun journey. And you know, this is a market in particular that it's going to be measured and certainly in years, decades, evolution, and kind of looking forward to what the future holds.
Yeah. Well, I know we want to talk mostly about crypto, and we've got a lot to talk about with respect to the space. Crypto has been in the news a lot, and of the most exciting developments, I think, in the last year have taken place just in the last, month or two. So we want to talk about that. But what I would love to do is maybe ask you about some of the backstory aspects of getting Teton set up and started. Mm-hmm. When I set up the podcast, I wanted to have a show that appealed to the builders and founders and entrepreneurs. And I would love to expand on the backstory. So I'm going to ask you some questions about forming Teton. When you thought about going from helping friends learn more about crypto and answering questions at parties and such to friends who are interested in crypto and were asking you questions, to then saying, I really maybe should turn this into a business. You've started companies before and had exits. What were some of the things that I guess you used to help convince yourself ultimately, like, I need to do this or I want to do this?
Yeah. So if I rewind kind of back to, this would have been, I think, fall of 2020 or spring of 21, crypto was kind of going through a bit of a bull market phase. That's when everybody was buying NFTs and, you could go get your hair cut and they were talking about getting crypto. That was probably the sign you should be selling at that point. But jokes aside, I had friends that were curious. They knew I was doing it. And, two friends that still don't know each other, but they had approached me separately and asked me if they could give me some of their money to invest for them. And I was like, not a chance, like not doing this. I'll give you some advice. And so I started a newsletter, and over the course of about a year, year and a half, I accumulated about 30 people on this newsletter. So, obviously private. And it was just pretty simple. It was like, here's what I'm buying. Here's why I'm buying it. Maybe a paragraph about it. Here's where you buy it at. And here's how you do that. And it's not in almost all cases, I believe, it was never as simple as go to Coinbase and buy it. It was get some cash in Coinbase, buy some stable coins, transfer it to some other exchange you got to have an account at and buy it. So I was so deep in it that I didn't realize how much I was asking people to do. And to me, it was a second nature. I mean, I had done this enough. So after about, the majority of that time doing that newsletter, I kind of started talking to people and I was like, oh, how's it going? You know, nobody bought anything. I was like, okay, either they're finding this entertaining or they're not even reading the emails and I'm wasting my time. But those two people kind of came back to me around the time I was having those conversations and they were like, would you consider taking money and doing this for us? I don't have time for this, but I'm curious. So, you know, initially I had said no because I was worried about compliance and all the scary things that you hear about happening, right? Or when people don't do them. So I was like, you know, I kind of in some sense, I felt like I owed it to those friends to have a good reason why I was saying no. So I had reached out to a securities attorney and was like, explain this to me. Like, is compliance is a big hairy beast, like I think, or what is it? To find out that, you know, under Reg D, it's, you know, if you're under a certain threshold, I think it's 110 million. It's not as scary, right? You can kind of hire people to do it. And it's, you know, something that is, can be done without too much headache. So gave it more thought and I was like, okay, I want to be able to help these friends, but I need to be able to do it in a way that's, you know, safe for me, safe for them. So the fund made sense to kind of set up and, get going. And that ended up being around the, spring of 22. And at that point I knew the market was not a spot to be making investments, crypto markets. We were, you know, kind of peaked, if you can think about it, at the end of December of 21 or fall of 21. And I just knew that we were maybe going to get to the bottom of a bear market, potentially in the summer of 22 or fall of 22. So I had started slowly getting the paperwork done and made the journey into, you know, getting everything done to the point where we launched October 1st of 22. The first half of of Q4 was awesome. A lot of excitement, you know, new investors, all that stuff. And then FTX and all that mess that everyone probably would like to forget about happened in middle of November. So it made for a rough start. But I kept reminding myself, I was like, you know, businesses are never easy to start. But at the end of the day, it probably wasn't going to get much darker than that moment was. You're a brand new fund. You're a first-time manager, and you have basically a black swan event happen within 45 days of start launching. And, you know, I have awesome investors in the fund. Nobody flinched. They were more curious than anything. And, you know, it became a moment to learn cadences about, you know, how often you talk to investors, how often you email them, all that kind of stuff. You know, each person kind of wants their own cadence. Some I basically never hear from. Others will text me on a weekly basis because they're just trying to stay up on the news. So it's been a journey. And, you know, having you on board has been super helpful. I jokingly refer to you as my chaperone sometimes because you understand the fun world. But it's a, you know, I think it's a good partnership. And kind of look forward to where this goes.
Yeah, I appreciate you giving that backstory because so many of the folks who elect to go from, let's say, working at a firm to then stepping out with a team or a partner, maybe sometimes alone, to set up a fund, it's a huge undertaking, as you know, to get a business stood up of any kind, but a fund. When you're not from the industry, when you haven't done it before, you haven't seen all the things that go into setting up a fund properly and running a business, an investment business properly as a fiduciary and all this stuff. So, I got to watch you as a friend figure that path out. And then when you asked me to sort of step in and help in certain areas, it's been very rewarding to watch somebody like yourself who's naturally extremely curious, but also like a real student of why are these things done this way? And then probably really cool to see how you have built that relationship and that cadence, like you said, with communicating with investors, reporting, trying to ensure that you're constantly reinforcing, you know, the value proposition. So, so really neat.
Yeah, I appreciate that. You know, it's, you know, the mechanics of a fund, are not how my brain would have set them up if I was the one in control of everything. But I understand why they do things the way they do. And just being able to, you know, kind of get to learn through that. I'm very much a person that if I don't learn something each day, I feel like I've wasted the day. I always want to be learning something. So,
yeah. Well, I say you're right on about, you know, the timing of setting it up. Like I know we've been to some events together, and when you look mm-hmm. back on this in 5 or 10 years, it's like probably one of the hardest times to launch a digital assets fund mm-hmm. Was when you launched it. Probably mm-hmm. one of the most difficult environments all small, new and emerging managers have faced in trying to grow the business and attract capital. You know, mm-hmm. being a new name, a new face, you know, this is an industry, let's be honest, where most of the dollars go to the biggest names, the biggest brands with right. the biggest platforms and resources and track records. So mm-hmm. you have all this stuff stacked against you. Mm-hmm. Before we jump into some of the topics, what keeps you going? Like, what is it about? Is it Teton or the strategy or mm-hmm. being your own boss and being a PM, a portfolio manager? Like, what is it that keeps you going despite some of those headwinds?
You know, I just have a love for the technology. Obviously, a goal is to make money. There's no doubt about that. But at the end of the day, I would be doing the same thing if I didn't have the fund. I would just be doing it for myself. So I kind of get to, in some sense, double dip. I get to enjoy the job, which is important. And I just love the flexibility of it. You know, it's not something that I have to do between 8 and 5. There's days that I'm out helping my wife with horses during the day, and I come in and I work in the evenings. And just generally, like, the markets, this is a market that doesn't sleep. And that it's the definition of that, right? It's 24/7, 365. And it's interesting, you know, earlier in my crypto journey, you know, I got in early 2018. You know, the markets are largely driven by what happened with the Asian buyers. So you'd wake up in the morning and be like, what did Asia do overnight? You really cared about that. Now it is largely flipped, especially with this ETF stuff we'll get into in a little bit with Bitcoin. It's, you know, but, you know, up until summer of 22, I felt like I could keep up with all of the news in crypto on a daily basis. There's not a chance I can do that now. Right. That's why specializing in the fund, you know, we're very focused on assets that solve cross-border payments, trade finance, supply chain management, and real world or tokenization more generally, but more focused on real world asset tokenization.
Yeah.
And it's tough to keep up with that news now, right? I mean, it's interesting to kind of see how fast this market's growing and just evolving and all the things that come along with that.
So. Yeah. Well, and I think you bring up a good point, which is you have to find balance in other, mm-hmm. other things. Like the people yeah. that tend to be so overly absorbed in mm-hmm. whatever it is, XYZ, it could be investing and trading, but it could be something else. Like those people mm-hmm. flame out, they burn out. So yeah. being able to step away from it, and because of what you're doing, I know we can't talk about the fund as a vehicle, as a security, but we can talk generally about the mm-hmm. markets, like your approach and your themes. They allow you to do deep research, and they allow you to spend time outside mm-hmm. of quote unquote normal market hours. This is by no means a normal market though. So let's right. just call that what it is. Yeah. This is not something that operates between 9, you know, and 4. Mm-hmm. So let's, as that is kind of the backdrop, let's talk a little bit about crypto, and more specifically, let's talk about kind of where we're at in the crypto market cycle.
Mm-hmm.
Set the stage for folks. I know we've got folks, when you say crypto, it's run for the hills, and you've got folks mm-hmm. that are going to listen that are invested in the space, some new, but some have been in it for years. So I know it's a lot to ask, but where are we in the cycle mm-hmm. from your perspective?
Yep. So you zoom way out, you know, the last time that, or the first time I was on your podcast, if we had this conversation, most people have been like, oh, crypto is drug money, or it's those crazy JPEGs that people are buying on the internet.
Yeah.
And that would be the vast majority of people. Fast forward to today, I think that is almost flipped. It might have been 80-20 before. It may be, you know, the opposite direction now. And, you know, we are certainly in a bull market cycle with crypto. Probably the beginning stages of it, or the beginning phases of it, if you want to kind of break it apart. We probably entered it in last October, November. Kind of some of the technicals kind of flipped. And that's when the news of the Bitcoin ETF started really percolating up. There's been requests for Bitcoin ETFs for, I think, 7 years. But once Fidelity, BlackRock, and Bitwise filed theirs, the market's kind of paid attention. And Franklin Templeton, I mean, there's nine of these things now. But it's almost like once BlackRock wanted it, they got it type mentality. And there's probably some validity to that. But, you know, there was a run up in the fall, up and through Christmas. And obviously the ETFs launched in early January. And there was a lot of questions around what was going to happen. Was it a sell the news event? And it was initially. The first week, it was definitely like it peaked the day that it launched. And then for the basically into the end of January, it was kind of a sell off. And then it's been up and to the right since then.
And when you say it launched, you're saying when the BTC, the Bitcoin ETFs launched.
Yes.
Which happened earlier this year at the, you know, sort of January, somewhere in January. Mm-hmm. When those launched, you're saying we started to see even more movement up and to the right.
Yeah. Yes. The actually, I should have prepared this part, but I would say look at the 3 month chart here. So the price peaked on the 11th at 48,000. It pulled back down to 38,000 at the end of, within a week. And now we're at 68,000 today.
Yeah.
We actually, this morning we hit an all-time high, and then it's kind of been down 3 or 4% from there. Yeah. You know, in crypto, if it's a single digit percent, it's kind of not moving. Right. So it's just, you know, magnitude's difference. You kind of get desensitized to it in some sense. So
when you started responding to the question, you say zoom way out, go back, you know, when we're in the sort of peak of the FTX saga and all the mess around Binance, you were hearing that there was talk about ETFs and applications were in there, and there was a lot of stuff happening behind the scenes. But people were just obviously broadly down on crypto. See another fraud. See another, you know, young tech wizard ran off with the money type of thing. You think that that has flipped? And
yes, that if you want to use a book analogy, that chapter's closed. Crypto in a lot of ways got cleaned up in 23. We didn't realize it in the moment. You had the FTX stuff as he kind of has trial. He was guilty. He'll be sentenced here in the next couple of weeks as we sit here in 24. And I thought all that was behind us. And then you kept hearing these rumblings of something's going to happen with Binance. Binance, you know, whether they're based out of China or somewhere in Asia, you know, still up for discussion, really, because they don't have a quote unquote headquarters. The biggest exchange by volume by far in the world. I mean, dwarf Coinbase for that matter. And then in November, the DOJ and the Fed announced charges and settlement the same day. It's like the biggest, I don't know if it's the biggest fine ever, but certainly a huge fine of $4.3 billion. Didn't have good AML practice. They didn't have good KYC. It sounded like an exchange where if you were a big enough whale, you could kind of specify your own terms. So they claimed that there was drug money going through it. There was human trafficking and then just general terrorist type financing stuff. So CZ, the CEO, he's actually still under house arrest in Washington State, I believe, and waiting his sentencing, I think, in May. But, you know, so Binance got cleaned up overnight. The volumes came way down. For all intents and purposes, Binance controlled, or the volumes on Binance control the Bitcoin price. And in hindsight, I'm glad it happened. And the day that it happened, I'm like, oh, here we go. We have another one of these events. We're going to drag this thing out a year. That quickly got cleaned up. And within a month, or probably within a couple of weeks for that matter, the news around Bitcoin ETFs, there was updated applications. It was a whole new kid. It was like so orchestrated.
When you zoom way out and we look at this thing 10 years from now, right? There will be revisionist history, as there always is. But when you zoom way out, I'm sure people that look at this are going to be like, well, God, sure, you knuckleheads, you had to get rid of all these bad actors before people with pension funds and retirement assets and Fidelity and BlackRock and these big shops were going to get involved. Like, they're, come on. So it has played out that way, right?
Yeah, and I'm glad that I don't have to always have the conversation with people now that it's about drug money. Like, that is, I would say it's fully stopped, but I don't remember the last time I had that conversation and had to explain how most of the volumes are not. And, like, honestly, more bad stuff happens with real physical dollars than it happens with crypto and all the things, the opposite of what Elizabeth Warren likes to speak about. So at the end of the day, it's a it's a new day in crypto. The ETFs definitely, if there was a close of that chapter, beginning of a new chapter, it was January the 11th when the ETFs launched.
Yeah.
And
it's, so let's talk about that. So you have, if we just wanted to break down the market, and we said you have thousands of cryptos out there. I mean, literally like stocks, there's thousands of different options, to invest in crypto. The biggest, most liquid, most actively traded of those are Bitcoin, Ethereum. These would be your mega caps, let's call it.
Yeah.
Why would you characterize those as mega caps?
Yep. So just to give listeners perspective, I mean, right now the total market cap of crypto is $2.66
trillion.
Bitcoin accounts, trillion with a T, yes. Bitcoin's market cap right now is $1.32 trillion. In basically a year, it has added $1 trillion in market cap.
Okay.
Much the way that,
so it's more than half.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I would say, yes. I mean, it's, I don't have the exact percentage here in front of me, but it is, up, high.
But when it, but when it moves, everything else just by simple, you know, connection generally, not always, but generally is going to move with it.
It's going to move. Yeah. And it doesn't, so say Bitcoin is up 10%, the rest of the market's not going to be up 10% initially,
right?
Or ever. It's a definitely a lag effect, and it's a, in some sense, trickle down, right? Through the different tiers. And you can kind of break the market caps up in, from mega caps of Bitcoin and Ethereum. And then you kind of might consider the next level there being what I might consider large cap tokens. So anything greater than a 1 billion with a B market cap. Valuation, and then you have anything that I would consider mid cap, so 100 million to 1 billion, and then small cap, anything under 100 million. And there's even some people even go to micro caps. At that point, it's all kind of, well, you know, it's a big sea of tokens. But
and when you so there's thousands of them out there. You have your way of breaking down the market. How do you, when you think about Teton and when you think about your firm and where you like to spend time doing research? You talked about at the very beginning of the show, you know, some of the themes, some of the areas, trade finance, tokenization. Put that together for us. You know, market caps, themes. Mm-hmm. How do you go about putting a frame around where do I want to spend time?
Yeah, you know, I've been in crypto since 2018. There was a lot less tokens back then. It was obviously, like I mentioned, easier to keep up with the news. So back then, you might have just considered it was one bucket outside of Bitcoin and Ethereum. Now that it's a much bigger market, just market cap and from a number of assets, you know, I tend to spend my time these days more in the small cap tokens. Those are tokens that are launching, just launched, you know, kind of early in their life cycle. And obviously, higher risk, higher reward. You can think of that whole market cap perspective or that scale as a big risk scale. And, you know, they admittedly these days, most of these projects are being launched outside the US because the US doesn't have sane regulation in place. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's still English speaking people. Heck, quite frequently I'll see projects launching where there are Americans that have moved outside the US, Singapore, Dubai, London, somewhere like that to launch a project because they have rules of the road that they can play by and choose to launch their startup. So, you know, there's a lot that goes into deciding if a project is investable, obviously, but at the beginning of the day, you know, I look at the small caps. There's a lot less news. You know, I have been fortunate enough to network myself into some private groups and message groups online. That's kind of like eyes and ears on the ground type situation. Some people that are obviously very passionate about whatever the market is. And these groups I'm in is about commercial utility, just more broadly. And
tell us, I mean, I know what that term means when you say commercial utility. The average person thinks about crypto, I think I'm going to be a skeptic here. Okay. Mm-hmm. What do we need it for? What is the mm-hmm. benefit? You hear blockchain technology and you hear crypto and digital assets. Mm-hmm. I want you to spend a minute talking about, you say commercial utility. Can you connect the dots mm-hmm. between when you say commercial utility and there are these projects out there?
Right.
And there's crypto tokens that you can then purchase. Mm-hmm. I'd love for you to draw a circle together with all that.
Yeah, I guess an overarching part of my thesis for the fund is the tokens that are going to get to real scale in value are the ones that will be solving business problems first, because it's easier for a business to adopt something than it is to convince the public to do it, because there's so much more rules and regulations that be put in place to get the public, legally involved, as well as you have to convince them of the use cases. And there's just so much more. So, you know, back in my previous business, part of what we were doing was payments with credit cards. And so I was kind of already in the payment space. That's how I initially got into crypto and was looking at cryptos that were solving payments problems across border payments in particular. And just kind of gravitated and kind of broadened the thesis as I did more research. When it's solving a commercial problem, to me, you as a citizen could end up using an app, a banking app, maybe cross, you know, you need to send money overseas. You have no idea you're using a crypto, but you are. I mean, it's probably not happening today, but we're close. And at the end of the day, there's a lot less friction to get a system like that. You know, if you go as far as you want to help the central banks around the world settle their currencies, that's a whole nother problem. There's some cryptos that are trying to solve that, but that is talking about slow moving, lots of friction, and obviously politics involved, which makes it even more difficult. But commercial utility is just somewhere that I've landed. In some sense, I like it because I'm not as interested in the news cycle or the hype cycle around whatever meme coin is happening. And there's a lot of meme coins in crypto right now that admittedly appear to be making money. Whether they're actually selling or thinking that this thing is going to go to the moon and they're going to be a trillionaire is what probably most people think. They'll end up being left holding the bag on that. So it's it's just a wild, wild west in some sense. But, you know, I love projects, for instance, that, you know, they appear to have undersized marketing budgets. When I see an oversized marketing budget for a project, that's like a big red flag that they're trying to they're more interested in selling their token than they are solving the problem. I come from the software world. So you often hear about projects that are trying to find product market fit. That's, you know, trying to build some software to solve some problem. And they're trying to figure out what are they need to be, small market, mid market, or enterprise level potentially. And I have started using the term, team market fit when it comes to these cryptos. Like, is the team right for the market they're trying to solve? Do they have experience? Do they have the connections? All the things that are needed. And quite often you see a lot of hammers looking for nails right now, and you have to be careful with that. So
yeah, I think to put a bow on what you're saying, for me, when I step back and think about Bitcoin and these ETFs, being able to, if you ask the investor, what value does Bitcoin play in business utility, commercial utility, mm-hmm. enterprise utility, right? Mm-hmm. I think it would be a different response than you say, why do we need NVIDIA chips? You know, people mm-hmm. would be oh, able for sure. to just understand. And I think what you're saying is there are tokens out there that stem from projects. Those projects have commercial utility, enterprise and business customers, governments, other big stakeholders are going to incorporate and are using those tokens in these projects to solve real problems in cross-border payments, in trade finance, in, we're going to get into tokenization. You know, these are trillion-dollar market opportunities where if they're correct and they're right, those projects, those tokens would, you know, be more valuable than they are today.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, crypto is evolving. So it's not as static as people think it is from the outside.
Yeah.
They may not understand it, but even if you're in crypto, you have to be on your toes because it, a month from now, things could be different enough where what you understood is no longer the case. So it's a,
It's dynamic. It's what you and I are talking about is not selling advertising on TV. What you and I are talking about is not generating headlines on CNBC, right? It's definitely much more in the weeds. It's much more about those, like you said, those channels where you're with a network of other
passionate individuals. Typically,
I don't want to call them geeks, but you're with other people that are crypto. They're crypto enthusiasts. They're software engineers. They're developers. They're cryptographers. And this is stuff that they live and breathe. And that's just a different subset that is not going to make the news.
Yeah. You know, the part that was very enlightening for me early in the journey is I remember we were sitting at our meetings at Global Alts Conference in Miami a year ago. And we'd start off the meeting. We'd be going through kind of the general thesis of the fund. And I'd be like, the fund does not hold Bitcoin or Ethereum. And you could immediately just see like, gone, this conversation's over.
Yeah.
Not because they thought we were crazy. They just had no idea what we'd be talking about after that.
Right.
And I'm like, you know, at the time I was like, soon enough, it seemed like we would be roughly a year later, but we would be getting a Bitcoin ETF. There's no sense in me buying it in the fund because it's going to be far cheaper for you to do it elsewhere.
Yeah.
And I, you know, Ethereum, I've got other issues with. And at the end of the day, I was like, and they don't, they're not solving problems. Bitcoin is functionally a digital gold, if you want to call it that. And then Ethereum is a platform. And I'll leave it at that, but it's a, you know, and then we started talking about other tokens and nobody had heard about anything that we had to talk about.
No.
Pretty entertaining.
I think we're a little ahead of where the market is. At least that's the conclusion we came to over dinner. That doesn't make them wrong and us right. It just means that we're
correct.
We're at a different stage and doing something different. Let's talk a little bit about this particular market and why this market is behaving differently than prior bull market cycles. I know you spend a lot of time looking at history and looking at prior bull market cycles, specifically with crypto. Why is this one behaving differently, or what are the characteristics that you are paying attention to about it?
Yeah, maybe in a sentence or two, I'll kind of explain how past cycles have largely been.
Yeah.
In the sense that, you know, money comes in, it flows into Bitcoin. Bitcoin does its run. It flows into kind of starts rolling, cascading, in a sense, down into Ethereum. And then the large caps, and then the mid caps, then the small caps. The small caps potentially have what they call these big blow-off tops, where they're basically going vertical, if you look at it on a chart. And then if you're lucky enough, you sell. If not, you end up holding the bag that'll be down 90% for 2 or 3 years. So that's what's happened in the past. This cycle is a little different. And admittedly, I think it's almost solely due to the funds that are coming in via the Bitcoin ETFs. Because Bitcoin has run, but so has run up. Ethereum is also not at its all-time high, but getting closer. And then the large cap tokens and some of the mid caps have also had good appreciation over the last month and a half. From the perspective of the fund, it's awesome because I don't feel like I'm being left behind right now versus having that lag effect. But you know, there's so much money coming in via these ETFs. I mean, BlackRock had publicly, I think even Larry Fink is the one that mentioned this. Their goal was to have $5 billion of AUM by the end of 2024. Within the first month, or just over, I think it was 5 weeks, they got to $10 billion. It was the fastest any ETF has ever gotten to $10 billion of AUM.
In history.
Perspective.
I mean, just in history. In history,
like right. any ETF. And not just the crypto ones, obviously, because there's only this one, any ETF. And just for perspective.
Like for context, how long did it take gold to get there?
3 years, I think. So, I mean, obviously, that was back in 2003 or something. So
yeah.
ETFs weren't as popular then.
People couldn't spell ETF.
Right.
You know, 10 years right. ago, as I joke, right? Now you have advisors that run billions of dollars.
Only ETFs.
With only ETFs, you know, and mutual funds are a bad word. Heaven forbid. We put money in a mutual fund. So it is interesting. So you see the, you know, what are there, 10 of these ETFs that have come to market more or less?
Right.
The biggest ones being BlackRock's, Fidelity's.
And Bitwise.
So, but you see the money flowing into those as playing a big role.
And obviously with any market, for every buyer, there's a seller. So there's sellers. And this is largely probably happening at OTC. So it's not like these ETFs are logging into a Coinbase account to do their work. But for everything that I've seen, if you look at Bitcoin available on exchanges like a Coinbase and OTC desks that are reporting Bitcoin that is available for sale, it is at a, I think, a four-year low, something like that. So it is quickly going, I wouldn't say to zero, but functionally going to zero. So at some point, you know, you think the simple rule of supply and demand is going to kick in. And at some point it has, the reason why the prices run. But I don't think we have seen what's about to happen. I think this has maybe been an appetizer of sorts, because you have the Bitcoin, halving that's coming up in late April.
Right.
The number of Bitcoin being created on a daily basis right now is 900 by the miners.
Let's talk about that real quick. So I've been personally digging into this liquidity and supply demand, and just to put some numbers around it for the audience. So there's 900 new Bitcoin mined.
Yes.
Roughly each day. Okay.
Yeah.
And there's a finite number of Bitcoin that will ever exist.
21 million. Exactly.
Right. And that by its designer, creator was set up by design. And this halving that is about to happen in April, we expect it to happen at some point in April, means what?
So the code that is Bitcoin, they started off in 2010 mining, and roughly every 4 years, it's on the number of blocks, and blocks can not always be the same number of seconds. So that's why it's roughly, but roughly every 4 years, you'll have what they call the halving event, where the difficulty to create new Bitcoin doubles from one block to the next, because blocks are sequential. And it's like literally a specific number block that happens. And the, you know, back in 2020 when this happened, you know, went from 1800 to 900. And now it's going to go from 900 to 450. And in an environment where supply is already constrained, or appears to be constrained, it's going to be interesting. Generally, in the past, when a halving event has happened, you've had Bitcoin run up because the miners functionally demand to be paid double the price of Bitcoin from the day prior, because they're getting half as much, or they're having to work twice as much to get the same. And, you know, it kind of depends on how you look at it. So this is not a hard thing to understand. It's you know, your first economics class you might have had in college. So it's interesting. But so 900 being created a day, and the number I'm looking at here is from February the 29th. So the last, I believe this is 7 days, or maybe 5 weekdays. I'm not quite sure. The ETFs consumed 10,050 Bitcoins, consumed, basically bought up. So a factor of 10, right? Or 11 for that matter. Obviously not sustainable long-term.
And BlackRock, we keep going back to BlackRock. They don't pay us to do this, but we're just using them. So they're the biggest, but they had their biggest single day of inflows this week. And we talked about 10.
It's accelerating.
Right. We talked about 10 billion, fastest ETF to 10 billion. And that's just one of the 10, right?
Yep.
That have hit the market. And most of the money is going into the three big ones or four big ones. But my point is, they're raising inflows into that ETF on the order of closing in on $1 billion a day.
A day, yes. They did have a $1 billion inflow day, if I'm not mistaken.
So they got to put that money to work.
Yeah, it's, you know, and it's been interesting because the way the mechanics of this, and this is something that's new to me, is they're taking this cash on a daily basis at the end of the market around 5 p.m. that they go out to the Bitcoin market and they buy the amount of Bitcoin to create the shares that they need to create.
Yeah.
You can literally watch the Bitcoin price move. Like, you know, not that it's like so easily visible that you can figure out how much volume that they had, because they're going to report that the next morning anyways. Mm-hmm. But it's just, it's been fascinating to watch.
Yeah. So I think, you know, to before we move on to the next topic, which we're going to talk a little bit about, what's next? That's always crypto. What's next? Okay. Are we going to see more volatility in price over the next period of time? And then there's the halving event. I mean, there's just going to be things to watch, clearly.
Yes. And, you know, like I mentioned at the start of this podcast, Bitcoin did have a new all-time high this morning, not by much, probably less than 0.5% over the previous high, which was, I think, earlier this week. But it needs, I mean, from a technical perspective, it needs to smash it and run, or we're about to keep hitting our head against this roof. It may not be the best sign. So that's one thing that I'm watching, you know, in the moment, effectively.
Yeah. Okay.
But it's a, you know, it's, you know, kind of the last little thing on this is like, you see all these projections and sometimes people are throwing up these price predictions. Mm-hmm. Kathy Witt is famous for hers. You know, there's a 500,000 or $1 million Bitcoin. Obviously that's years in the future and assuming it all goes well. And she probably is not wrong. I just don't know the time frame it happens in. But, you know, we're at 67, 68,000 today. I mean, this cycle, I would not be surprised if we get to 200, 250, 300.
Yeah.
Like,
but nobody's put out a model. Nobody's put out.
There's no models. Research.
Yeah.
Yeah. People are throwing darts. And I would love to see reasoning. And it's probably pretty hard to model, admittedly.
Yeah.
This, the randomness of the market. But, you know, how that cascades into these other tokens will be interesting. Like, obviously, the Bitcoin price is being driven up, but the sellers of the Bitcoin, that's what, at current prices, that's what I would really be curious to know what they're doing. And it feels like they're buying into the other mega or large caps right now, because that's why their prices are moving sooner in the cycle than they would have otherwise in past cycles.
Yeah. They're replacing Bitcoin with whatever it is, Solana or
a joke I told someone the other day is all the boomers that are buying Bitcoin in their brokerage accounts now are overpaying for Bitcoin in some sense to all the millennials that can't afford to buy the houses that boomers have. So
that's true.
It's coming full circle.
Yeah. So. Yeah. You're funny. So, okay. Let's switch gear and talk a little bit about Ethereum and the market. So you saw the work of getting these ETFs to market, these spot Bitcoin ETFs take some time. You had to clean up the market, if you will, with some of the bad actors that happened. You could make an argument that that has cleared the path for other tokens to now, you know,
get an ETF,
come forward and other issuers to bring. Why do you think, and what are the ramifications around an Ethereum ETF over the next, you know, 6 to 12 months?
Yeah, if you want to say that Bitcoin drew up the plans for how to get a crypto ETF, you would first have to say that there has to be a futures ETF for that asset in place. Okay, Ethereum has got that as of this last summer, I believe. Okay, in some period of time later, you can get the spot. The thing with Ethereum that I find intriguing is the SEC never tried to say that Bitcoin was a security. It functioned as a commodity, and there's never been a real dispute around that. Partially because there's no one to sue. That there's no central organization, because the SEC does like to sue randomly. So Ethereum, there is a central organization. There's the Ethereum Foundation. There's Consensus, which is one of the guys that helped start Ethereum, started Consensus. It functionally is not a foundation, but kind of acts like it's an enterprise. It sells into JP Morgan, for instance, uses some of Consensus stuff. it is, you know, if it's is a security or not, the SEC won't claim one way or the other. So it's just this whole gray area that the SEC leaves crypto in. You know, I think that the challenge with an Ethereum ETF or any of the cryptos, you know, here's another buzzword, that are proof of stake. Mm-hmm. So Bitcoin is proof of work. You do mining. You burn electricity effectively and you get tokens. But proof of stake is not as energy intensive. It's about locking value up in the network and you get tokens. And you functionally, there's like an interest or there's like a cash flow on it because there's interest.
Right.
If you stake your tokens, yep. It's a yield, right? So right. If you stake your tokens, it's very much akin to putting money in a bank account. And getting
it's like a, I mean, I've heard it compared to like the bond of crypto or.
Sure. Yep. That's another way to think about it.
Yeah.
So I will be interesting to see, assuming we get one, how the ETFs, do they give some of that cash flow back or that yield back? Do they keep some of it for themselves? Like, because the Bitcoin ETF, the only way they've differentiated themselves is really based upon the fees they're charging. They can talk about the custody and everything, but the custodies, in theory, should all be functionally the same. There's more levers and more knobs for them to turn with a proof of stake or an Ethereum ETF. They can talk about case custody because there's voting that happens within a proof of stake system. Like, would you have voting rights? Well, in theory, you kind of do, but did they expose those to you? You know, last I checked, over 50% of the Ethereum network is held by Coinbase and two other exchanges, which admittedly I'm forgetting right now. So like they have majority control of the network. That's a bit of a concern. That mm-hmm. seems rather centralized. Bitcoin is obviously decentralized. So I don't know. There's a lot of things around it, but Ethereum is the next largest market cap token. So in theory, it does feel rather natural for it to be the next ETF.
Right. Yeah.
Is it? I don't know. Time will tell. You could also make the case that XRP should be the next one because it actually has legal clarity. That is not a security.
Yeah.
But you also have to get the ETFs approved through the SEC, and that's the SEC lost that case on the XRP. So it's, you know, it's another day in crypto, but it's muddy. So
yeah, muddy is for sure. So, yeah. But I think everybody that is a crypto observer, watcher, and now many and more every day are becoming investors in the space. It wouldn't surprise many of these folks over the next few years that we're going to see a lot more ETFs.
Yeah, I think you're going to see, you know, obviously right now it's asset specific ETFs. You're going to start to see baskets of these things or baskets within sub markets. You know, at some point, maybe there's a commercial utility basket. Would not surprise me.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's, you know,
it's just the way
it's all about how they make it up. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Let's get to something that you are hearing more and more about. And this is something that I particularly am passionate about and interested in because I've spent, you know, a lot of my career working in the private markets and alternative assets in things like real estate and private equity and private credit. And I think that world, you know, is very interesting and is going to grow. And more investors are going to get exposure and want exposure to the private markets. And the notion that you can tokenize assets, real world assets, RWA. I know is a theme that that you have been working on for some time. So talk about real world tokenization. Mm-hmm. Why is it interesting? What are some of the bigger opportunities that get you excited?
Yeah. You know, so at the beginning of the year when I sent out my first newsletter to the investors of the fund, I told them I felt like this bull market cycle is likely to have a couple different themes to it, but one of them I think would be tokenization. And then the ETFs launched, and then like literally the next day that Larry Fink's on TV talking about this ETF and how it's going well, or maybe the first week, he was like, oh yeah, and I believe that tokenization is going to happen. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is happening so much faster than I thought it might. And obviously it's going to be a long drawn out process, but you know, tokenization can mean a lot of different things. It can mean you can take a private fund and you can tokenize the shares in it to potentially add some liquidity or secondary market to that. You can have, you know, all the way down to tokenization of stocks and bonds. You know, Franklin Templeton has a tokenized bond fund. It's not the most popular thing, but it's out there.
Yeah.
but you have a few cases where there's tokenization of equities right now. Not all equities, but I think maybe 20 of them. And so that trades 24/7, which is kind of interesting, that you have a market that is synced somehow. I don't even know the mechanics of it, but it's hooked to a market that's, a 9:30 to 4 type situation. But, tokenization to me is basically adding a market or the potential to add liquidity to something that functionally is illiquid, I think is the way that I process it. You have lockups and, a lot of times funds are limited to the people they know or the organizations they know. That is the network of it. If you start tokenizing something, you get it out on the internet, it's a little potentially more broadly. Obviously, there's KYC and AML and all the important things need to be there, but you start to have a more broad audience that could potentially be part of something. I follow a project that is literally a platform to help, basically call it businesses, tokenize something. It could be, like we talked about stocks and bonds, it could be funds. They're even dog fooding their own products. They announced this last week where you're going to be able to buy into equity in their business, in their startup with a tokenized shares on a blockchain that shares in the cash flow and all the normal rights that you may have. But it's a fascinating world because it's changed a lot. It used to be that people would refer to tokenized things as, oh, I want like a car title or a house deed to be an NFT. And that's true. And right. That would be very representative of how it works today.
Yeah.
I think where tokenization kind of takes it up another notch and adds a ton more flexibility and options is you can fractionalize things. So it's not just like, oh, I own the whole car. Well, I could own 10% of the car and I could sell off the other 90% to 1,000 other people. If I wanted to, it's a silly example, but I think it illustrates the ability of the technology, and it just, in some ways, it starts lowering the barrier to entry. Granted, we need to change some laws in the country to really make this happen around letting non-accredited investors make those type of investments, because usually it's the accredited world only can touch this stuff, and being able to slice things into smaller pieces that are cheaper. Assuming the laws are different for accreditation, you can, or that just goes away totally, you could have a totally different kind of market. And obviously there's education and a lot of other stuff that needs to happen there, but it's a, you can quickly go down rabbit holes in this stuff.
Yeah, you can. And this is where I'm for the audience, I'm constantly pushing Robert to say, okay, we could spend the rest of the show talking about, different themes, but I want to drill into the projects, and I want the benefit of the audience. I want them to hear how your sort of mind works, how your process works, how you do the research. So mm-hmm. Let's talk about the tokenization projects, and specifically go all the way back to some of the fundamental tenets that you're looking to see when you're trying to decide, mm-hmm. Okay, I want to get exposure with capital with my clients mm-hmm. to tokenization. I want to find a team that has what characteristics. I want to see what type of traction. I want to see what their marketing budget looks like. Because mm-hmm. I'll be honest with you, the skeptic in me is like when I turn on crypto Twitter, I turn on social media, everybody, oh, we can tokenize private credit funds. We can tokenize this mm-hmm. and that. And I'm like, who's actually doing the work? Mm-hmm. Who's actually building a token? Of course you could tokenize it, but mm-hmm. here you have an opportunity and I have the chance to ask you to illuminate mm-hmm. a real team doing real work, mm-hmm. getting real traction. What does that process look like though? How do you find them? How do you vet it mm-hmm. and diligence it?
To me, this is a very natural thing to do. I get from the traditional fund world, what I'm about to say is probably going to make people really tilt their head and be confused. It starts on Twitter or X for me. Like I start searching, and that's where all the real time stuff in the world is coming together. It's just the platform that I have found that works for me. I'm not saying it's the only way to do it. Certainly not the case. And some of these private groups that I'm in, people will post ideas that they're watching. This particular project that I'm referring to, I'll mention the name. This is certainly not investment advice, but it's Stobox, STOBOX. they're the platform that helps the businesses that we were kind of referring to do tokenization. Mm-hmm. And I ran across them on a tweet. I found it interesting because I just felt like tokenization generally was a topic that I'm interested in. This is back when I was more exploring the idea of adding tokenization as a potential market segment within the fund, and just started following it. And I'm like, okay, you know, at first is like, does this even seem professional? I mean, like this is a very low bar. Anyone can make a website. Does the team that's interacting on Twitter, do they actually seem respectful? Like you start with a very low bar and then you kind of just work it up. And then you start seeing, okay, are they saying what they're doing? Sometimes these projects are so early that they don't have any customers. Okay, that's probably not investable for my fund. But as they kind of make progress and you start to see, okay, they followed through, they've hit these milestones, whatever it may be. And then it comes down to, you know, oh, okay, they said that they were working on getting a partnership to do X and it happened. And that other partner's even saying it. So you start to getting some outside connections.
And I want to interject because it's not just any partner. It's just not just any customer. They're getting, in the case of some of the holdings, I know governments, and they're getting central bankers to like share a stage with them. I mean, and those are the kinds of things where it's like, oh, that's actually a really good data point.
Right. I mean, I watch a lot of YouTube because when you start to seeing, like you're talking about them being on a panel with a central banker or some kind of other very highly regarded entity, you start to be like, okay, those people from that entity probably would not be on a stage, or they would try not to be on a stage with the clown. So, you know, nothing is foolproof, but you just start adding all these breadcrumbs together to kind of start to build a case around something.
Yeah.
This Stobox, just this, I think it was yesterday, the day before, they announced that they're tokenizing, I think it's like $200 million project in the Middle East about a shrimp farm.
Yeah.
Seems rather bizarre, but they're tokenizing that to help raise the funds to do it.
They eat a lot of fish in the Middle East, in the Gulf States, right? So you start seeing a theme here. And for those of us that are so in our little bubble in our little world, right? Mm-hmm. It is sometimes hard to see, like, well, why would somebody go to Asia to do that when they could do that same project in Louisiana? What, like, it can't be real. If they're not doing it in my backyard, it can't possibly be real. But I know I'm being simple here, but why should we be paying attention to that in Asia? Maybe. And the size alone is like, gets my attention, but
yeah, I mean,
talk about that.
I probably fall back to the U.S. is 4% of the world's population. There's a lot of smart people that are not in the U.S. Start there. And I think admittedly, over the last three plus years with this SEC administration, it has been an absolute shit show. And that's saying it politely. Like, they have done everything they can to drive this kind of innovation away or try to make it not happen. All it's doing is pushing it offshore. And many of the crypto executives, Brian Armstrong at Coinbase, Brad Garlinghouse at Ripple, have all said they advise startups that want to start in the U.S. to not and figure out a way to move outside the U.S. to do it. And that is incredibly sad. Mm-hmm. America is known for innovation. And we're just in this phase with crypto that if you want to do it, you got to be outside the U.S. But to me, crypto is borderless. Outside of the different, you know, local regulations, these teams are largely distributed. There may be somebody that lives in the U.S. working for this team at Stobox that is based outside.
Yeah.
So, you know, the borders aren't as important, but it's in some sense, they're probably local to their customers. You know, I know that there's a team for Stobox that is often visiting the Middle East and obviously consulting with, you know, for instance, this fund doing this shrimp farm.
Yeah. So that's an important data point that they've got a real customer, a real project, clearly, you know, several hundred million dollars. And that is a good data point. If I'm hearing you correctly, like when you're thinking about research and is that eventually a token that you would like to continue diligencing and underwriting, like that, that there is a good data point.
Yeah. I mean, this $285 million shrimp farm, I think is meaningful to Stobox because I think up until this point, they've at least only publicly said they've got like just shy of 400 million tokenized already. So it's like obviously probably the biggest deal ever that they've done to help facilitate. And obviously I'm sure they hope it's successful, but nothing's guaranteed.
Sure. So, yeah. And again, you said this, we're not giving investment advice. People have to do their own research. The point of talking with you is not certainly to promote a fund or promote any individual tokens. It's really just to shed light on, there is a much broader conversation clearly happening in digital assets beyond just what we see hit the headlines. And I think you and I both share a passion around education, our curiosity of, this is a much bigger market. There's a much bigger narrative. And you might not hear about it because it's not the mainstream. And yet capital ultimately is going to move, we think, into these areas, these tokens and these projects where there's real enterprise utility, real commercial utility. And I think that, that just makes sense.
And a general challenge for a fund that is based in the U.S., or even if it's an individual for that matter, is how do you actually buy these tokens? And it's, again, Coinbase is not going to have Stobox on it, like at least not initially, doesn't now. And it's, you know, there's three or four exchanges out there, but they are, they do not allow U.S. entities at all to buy them. Like they're very strict about it because they don't want to deal with the problems that the U.S. has around this. So you have to be able to, in this case, be able to buy it on a decentralized exchange. You even have to know what that is. You need to figure out how to use it. Like there's so many barriers. So like, to me, that's like where it provides the extra return, because you could potentially get in early because there's such a lack of potential investors, even if they're curious and want to do it. So
yeah, I was thinking about like turning this into a paid podcast where like I create bonus content. And I think one of the cool bonus content pieces I could create is the time you and I tried to set up my my key
ledger wallet,
my ledger wallet. And I sit there after 30 minutes with you. And here I am, I think I'm sort of forward thinking and, you know, have a decent grasp on basic technology. And certainly I'm exposed to the space. And I'm like, who in their right mind would take the time to do this, to try to own some of these tokens? But it's a real problem.
And this is an aside, but like, this is why people leave stuff on exchanges. And when the exchanges get hacked, they lose their stuff. I mean, that's this is why ETFs are great, because they deal with the custody of it for you.
That's right. Right. They do solve a real practical and real world problem. Well, look, I know we've hit an hour. I can't believe it already, but so much to break down. I want to ask you a couple of final questions. You've got some time now behind you in terms of setting up the fund, and what would you say advice is to folks that are wanting to set up a fund or get into this space and manage capital for third parties? And what are some of the lessons learned that you'd say, man, I wish I'd known that?
This is the naive side of me, having never been part of a fund before. But early on, I didn't understand why everything moves so slowly. Like, it's measured in weeks to get things done. I'm used to technology and being able to do something and, you know, click something, be done, or maybe measured in days, not weeks. So patience is important, but be willing to kind of push, when you think things might need to move faster.
So. Yeah. And then So being patient, and then the reality is, it's gotten harder. Like I often try to just call out the reality that most of the capital across every single asset class, alternatives included, digital assets included, as we're seeing with these ETFs, flows to a concentrated number of players,
managers.
Yep. And that's certainly the case in digital assets. Having said that, what are some of the things that get you excited about being not one of those? What can you do when you do have a more nimble, more agile?
Just generally, setup? I would say, for Teton, I think it's, you know, I believe that the thesis is right, obviously, or I wouldn't be doing it, but more generally, I think being willing to be patient with it and know that this market is a developing market, it's early days. But if I'm right, you know, assuming I am, the payoff could be gigantic. because you're so early in something. This is like buying Amazon when it was $10. Or, you know, and people often,
and holding.
Kind of back to your question, and holding, yes. This is, we should set this up front. The fund is a long-only fund. It's not actively traded.
Right.
This is a multi-year bet.
Yeah.
At a minimum. And it's just something, you know, again, it comes back to patience, being willing to be like, you know what, today's down. I've read the news. You know what? I don't have to do something today. Like, you don't have to make a decision about something generally. So,
yeah. Just, and in our day and age, right? Activity. We need to constantly be showing
value. What did you do
today?
What'd
you do for me today? It goes against, again, a lot of the things. Mm-hmm. Even though, and the industry lost, and the world lost a generous philanthropist in Charlie Munger. And when you really study Buffett and you study Munger, and you recognize some of the things that I don't even think we appreciate, some of the insight and wisdom. I think it will be generations of folks that will ultimately, and I've seen that in writing from other tributes. But when you think about some of the basic fundamental things that those two talk about, it's like buy really, you know, great businesses at fair prices and hold.
Yeah.
It's very hard to do.
Don't touch it. Yes.
It's very hard to do.
Yep. Absolutely.
Robert Swarthout, the founder, CEO, and portfolio manager of Teton Crypto Capital. Thank you for joining me today on the ATL Alts podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Good luck going forward, and I'll look forward to having you back to do another show in the future.
Awesome. Take care.
Take care.